And the voice of Jackie Opal, recorded in Jamaica. He spent a lot of time in Jamaica. I think he was killed in an automobile accident in Jamaica. But Jackie Opal out of Barbados. And joining us on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn. Are you there?
I hope so.
It sounds like you're there. So how are you doing today?
Fine, and yourself?
Pretty good. How can you hear me?
Sure.
All right. So Dr. Gerald Horn is fresh from Paris and working on a new book on Haiti. And you're doing many, many books. So give yourself a plug right now before we start, because we got a hot 40 minutes with you.
What do you mean?
Now, what are you working on right now? I just want you to
let. Oh, I see, the Haiti book.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a look at the relations between not only the U.S., but I would say North America and Haiti from the beginning of the revolutionary process in 1791 until the failed attempt in the 1870s for the United States to annex what is now the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall that a few decades earlier, in the 1840s, the Dominican Republic was born in separating from Haiti.
Correct.
And this is quite extraordinary, the fact that a nation is born in separation from a mostly black nation. And it's not an exaggeration to say that the separation of the Dominican Republic from Haiti in the 1840s was really sort of a white supremacist backlash to the Haitian Revolution that was engineered in no small part by the United States. It's interesting that before the creation of the Dominican Republic in the 1840s, you had the Haitian leadership who were inviting black Americans from the United States to Samana and Puerto Plata, which are both in present-day Dominican Republic. And obviously, the Haitian leadership was inviting thousands upon thousands of black Americans to live there to bolster their claim to that part of Hispaniola, the island. But then after the Dominican Republic comes into being, that means that now these black Americans were no longer citizens of Haiti. They were citizens of the Dominican Republic. And what's interesting is that by the 1870s, the United States had this idea that they were going to annex the Dominican Republic, and then actually move on to try to annex Haiti itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea was to ship thousands, if not millions, of black Americans to Hispaniola, and not to mention having more Europeans come there, too, and create this sort of typically white supremacist society that you had on the mainland of North America. But things didn't pan out, and so therefore you have two independent nations still in Hispaniola, Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
Well, I wanted, before we start this interview and talk about the great Rob Ford, I wanted to mention that when I was growing up, I remember hearing about a man by the name of Carlos Cooks, who was, I guess, he took over from 1940 when Marcus Garvey passed away. Carlos Cooks started what was called the African Nationalist Pioneer Movement, and he was a very, very black nationalist, and he was, unfortunately, he was an anti-communist, and I found out later that Elombe Brath was a big follower of Carlos Cooks, and I used to live with General Gordon Baker, who was the founder of the League, one of the founders of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And he had some ties with Carlos Cooks in his very beginning. But I'm mentioning Carlos Cooks because Carlos Cooks was born in the Dominican Republic, and he really hated the Dominican Republic. If you read his books, he talked about the Dominican Republic like it was a South Africa or Mississippi.
I wonder if he was from Puerto Plata or Samana. And if, I mean, since he has an Anglo surname, it certainly points in that direction.
I think he was, yeah, because his father was, he had some ties to the English-speaking Caribbean. What is the breakdown of Santo Domingo? The Africans, Africans from the Caribbean were basically like bold, taken here, there, and everywhere, right?
Say that again?
I see Africans like Kwame Ture. I finished reading Kwame Ture's book, and he talked about his mother being born in Panama, having Antiguan background, and his father, grandfather being a Barbadian. I'm saying Caribbean people were like, not like people in the U.S. The Caribbean people moved from territory to territory. That's what I'm saying. Where we move from.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, sure. There's a lot of back and forth. There's a large population of Haitian origin in Cuba, a large population of Jamaican origin in Cuba. In fact, in my Cuba book, which will be coming out next year, I talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the backlash against those two particular communities, in particular, after the United States seizes control of Cuba in 1898.
Right. Now, it was a big story in the Globe and Mail, which I have not read. I was going to purchase it, but I was going to came here kind of early and was going to read the story about Rob Ford in the Globe and Mail, but I did not get a chance to read it because our internet is down, but it's all over the news, whereas it's basically, I guess the biggest new revelation is that Ford is supposedly, and the Ford family are basically drug dealers. That's the latest allegation, and
say that again.
The Ford family, they are drug dealers now. According to the Globe and Mail, they are dealing. They have been dealing in drugs for years. That's the latest allegation. I understand it's a huge story, a front page story in the Globe and Mail. Like I said, I couldn't read it because the internet is down, but that is the latest allegation. His minister.
Well, let me ask you something. Why are we just finding this out?
Why? I think that people. Why are we finding it out? I agree with what you're saying. I think that there's a split within the ruling class, and they want to get rid of him. People have known it all the time, but I think that what you were telling me the other day. There's a sector of the ruling class that wants to get rid of him, and they knew, people probably knew all the time, but now they want to get rid of him now for whatever reason. Now, you told me that there's a big story and we should be following something that took place in Sicily, I believe, related.
Well, yeah, there were a number of Canadian nationals who were supposedly dealing in drugs who were slain in Sicily.
Slain in
10 days.
Right.
Now, perhaps because I don't live in Canada, I'm not constantly processing Canadian news,
mm-hmm,
like those of you in Toronto. So I immediately put two and two together, if you like. In other words, I put the two Canadian stories that were in the forefront of my consciousness together.
Right.
The Sicily story and the Rob Ford story, and said that somebody needs to look into them.
Right.
But what would get to me about Rob Ford in his statement yesterday is he got bad advice. I mean, he must think that we're all dumb. He thinks that if he speaks in the present tense, I do not use crack,
mm-hmm,
then that'll be the end of the story. But you don't have to be a lawyer to say, well, what about the past tense?
He didn't say anything about that in the press. It's the same thing you're saying. The press has been killing him with that. Is what you're saying.
Well, of course. I mean, it's like, I'm looking at you right now on camera. So, yeah, I can tell you're not using drugs right now at this precise moment. So, yeah, okay, fine. You're not using drugs. But what about, 10 minutes ago when you're not on camera? I mean, he must think, does he think people are dumb? And then the next question, and this does not speak well for Toronto, I'm afraid. And as you know, how did this guy get elected? I mean, given Toronto's self-estimate of being so sophisticated and so cosmopolitan and so with it, how did she wind up electing a drug-dealing, crack-smoking reactionary?
Well, I will quote Vladimir Ilyich Lenin and say, only Allah knows.
No, dig down into the electoral statistics. I mean,
well, people say...
Let me tell you, what I hear on the radio, mm-hmm, is that there's a split in Canada, that it's like a donut, and that people in the center of the city oppose to him, people on the outskirts support him. Okay, who are these people on the outskirts, and why do they support him?
Well, I don't believe that. I believe that many people in the inner city supported him. I hear that all the time, that it was the 905, which is like the suburbs of Toronto, and the inner city where I live. We are supposed to be the sophisticates. We would not vote for an idiot like Rob Ford. But Rob Ford played that anti-homophobia card. The guy he was running up against was happened to be gay. He was in a same-sex marriage. He used that. He also used the fact that he was playing the poverty thing. He was going to do a number on the taxes. And I think he got a lot of support from the fundamentalists, black fundamentalists, the African people that are Christian, the Buddhists, not necessarily the Buddhists, but the fundamental Muslims. They didn't want this gay mayor. And the first of all, there's Toronto's mayoral election is not as bad as L.A., but it's a low turnout, so a lot of people that don't vote. And the people that vote bought Rob Ford's foolishness. That's my assessment.
Yeah, and also the press needs to engage in some self-criticism. I mean, really. The Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail in the first place. Because I find it hard to believe that all these stories that are coming out now could not have been discovered before the election. I refuse to believe that.
Had it been Obama, or had it been, not necessarily Obama, but had it been it would have come out. No, I agree. I agree, but I think I agree with your assessment that the there's a, I guess maybe a split in the Canadian ruling class, and they want to get rid of Ford for whatever reason. I don't know what the situation is, but it looks like he's been set up beautifully.
Yeah, and the guy is obviously, terribly naive. Whiz. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, I had the displeasure of bumping into him on the elevator at City Hall, and he's very polite and so on and so forth, but he is, I can't see how a cosmopolitan city like Toronto, how can he be the mayor of one of the most multinational, if not the most multinational city on the planet Earth, a very sophisticated city in terms of, you have three daily newspapers, you got all kind of weekly newspapers, you have a strong ethnic press, you have Chinese papers, you have South Asian papers, you have African Canadian newspapers, you have talk shows, three or four talk shows, sports channels. I mean, this is a talk show city. This is a city where black people, Nigerians, will get on the sports channel and talk about hockey. You know what I mean? It's like very literate city, and I just can't believe that I live here, could bring a buffoon like Rob Ford and have him be the mayor of this city. It makes no sense to me.
Well, let me add one more point, and this allows us to segue and switch gears. One of the things that struck me, particularly being in France, where I was up until a few days ago, and is this. Now, first of all, in France, you get an idea of the fruits of a true bourgeois democratic revolution. I'm speaking of the French Revolution of 1789, as opposed to a fake and fraudulent bourgeois democratic revolution, that is to say, the United States, 1776, which basically, of course, just ossified slavery and allowed for the liquidation of First Nations. So, but in France, you basically have the liquidation of the royalty, of feudalism. And so in France today is, people take to the streets all the time. look at the United States, this crisis. There's been hardly any demonstrations. You have demonstrations in Paris just about every day of thousands and thousands of people. It's basically a social democracy with a socialist president, Francois Hollande. Of course, we know about the deficiencies of social democrats, so please, I don't need a lecture about that. I'm just saying, once again, sometimes I feel my friends in Toronto don't understand the concept of relativity. That is to say, when you say the social democrats are better than the democrats and republicans, you're not saying the social democrats are paradise. You're just saying they're better than democrats and republicans, full stop. So, but now France is going through a crisis because during the Cold War period, it could basically engage in a kind of balancing act between Moscow and Washington. Of course, it left the military wing of NATO, for example. Its nuclear policy, all points of the azimuth, they basically, Charles de Gaulle basically said, well, we're not necessarily pointing all of our nuclear missiles at Moscow, and then left hanging the possibility they might be pointed at Washington, you see. But now with the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, the right wing was empowered globally, and now the social democracy of France is under threat, and it's put enormous pressure on the socialists and the social democrats. I'm not sure if they'll be able to stand up to the pressure, quite frankly. And this raises another point, which I think is relevant to Canada and perhaps even to Rob Ford. It seems to me that the retreat of the socialist project in Europe has had a devastating ideological impact on both Europeans and Euro-Canadians and Euro-Americans. And it's empowered some of the more retrograde elements in all of those communities. And I think that you see this in particular with regard to the reaction that you now see in Stockholm, Sweden, with the so-called riots that have been taking place for the past week, led by mostly immigrants, Somalis and Iraqis and Afghans, etc., and the rather hard-line, hard-nosed attitude taken to these people and to immigrants by the Swedish mainstream. And of course, Sweden is another example of a social democracy that is under challenge and under threat. And with their reaction to the immigrants, it's unclear to me, at least, whether the social democrats will be able to face the challenge. And I think that this is something that Canadians need to look at very carefully, since obviously there are many parallels between Canadian society and European society. That is to say, those immigrants who are under siege right now in Stockholm, you have to wonder if immigrants or immigrant-descended communities in Toronto may be facing a similar or an enhanced fate akin to that. And, of course, this also bleeds into the situation in London. I'm sure you saw the story about...
Gerald, before you go to London, I wanted to say something. I just saw a film with Yuri Kochiyama and Angela Davis, a conversation between them. And Angela Davis was pointing out that, you know, the U.S. had bigger demonstrations like before the Iraq war than we had Vietnam. The point that you were making about... the demonstrations not taking place in the U.S. like they're taking place in France. Now, Angela wasn't saying that they're on par with France, but she was arguing that there has been resistance to the U.S. policies. But I just want to throw that in there. You were talking about London.
That's true, but you know that was in 2000. That was 10 years ago.
But she was talking about you were talking about London. I didn't want to cut you.
Yeah, but in London, I'm sure you saw the video.
Yes, sir.
That seemed to present and seemed to depict a very gruesome story of two British nationals of Nigerian descent who supposedly are recent converts to Islam, basically butchering this British soldier, and then they are subsequently shot by arriving police and then bundled off to jail. Now, this has caused quite a storm in Britain, although I have to say, once again, even though Britain is not as progressive as France or Sweden, I still think that the reaction to that gruesome, grisly episode in London was much more restrained in many ways than it would have been in the United States. I mean, for example, British commentary is split. Some call it an act of terrorism. Some just say it was a hate crime. That is to say, it has nothing to do with terror in the sense of an attack on civilians, since this was a soldier. I mean, they're making those sorts of distinctions. Now, I should say, in all fairness, that in the aftermath of this episode in London, there have been Islamophobia attacks on Muslims in London. And once again, given the close ties between London and Toronto, I would hope that our friends in Toronto are paying very close and careful attention to this.
Well, the whole question of Islam and Toronto, the U.S., I mean, I must admit, many of my best friends are Muslim, and many of my family, a lot of my family are Muslim, so I know they are, what I've noticed among a lot of Muslims is that, and these are Muslims that are not reactionaries, or these are progressive Muslims, are distancing themselves from some of these other Islamic forces because there is such a thing as terrorism. For example, the Cubans did not support the whole 9/11 thing. A lot of people don't realize that, but when it was supposedly blowing up all the Americans because all these Americans were supposed to be all Americans were supposed to be messed up, the Cubans made a distinction between, you know, the working class, the Africans, and the, I guess, Latinos. And I guess Bin Laden was saying that anybody that wasn't a Muslim was fair game, if I'm not mistaken. That was his position, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. But I'm saying that, Toronto is, people are the anti-imperialist forces are shaping up. Like, I went to this film on Uri Kochiam and Angela Davis the other night, and it was mostly women, and it was a very, very, it wasn't a sellout because they didn't sell tickets, but I saw a lot of all nationalities, and I saw a lot of anti-imperialism and imperialist people, and I see promising front that could develop out of this.
Well, you know, what's striking about the present moment is that world imperialism is both fighting so-called Islamic fundamentalism and collaborating with it.
Correct, right.
I mean, that's what's so contradictory and ironic. I mean, we've talked many times on Saturday Morning Live, particularly during the Libyan crisis of 2011, how NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, of which Canada and the United States are leading members, turned the tables on Colonel Gaddafi. And they had worked out an agreement with him to contain and quarantine the so-called fundamentalists, and then they turned the tables on him and aligned with the fundamentalists to overthrow him. And then now you see the fruits of that. You saw in the last 48 hours the attack on Niger, where apparently approaching Niger from southern Libya, these so-called Islamic militants basically had a suicide bomb attack on a uranium mining facility and on a military base, killing over a score of individuals. Apparently, these are the same forces who attacked the natural gas plant in Algeria in just a few months ago, if you'll recall. And what's striking is that that tendency is spreading like wildfire across the southern boundaries of the Sahara Desert into so-called sub-Saharan Africa. And it's directly attributable to the overthrow of Gaddafi that was pulled off in league with so-called Islamic fundamentalist forces. And you see the same thing in Syria, for example, where the most militant fighting forces are affiliated with al-Qaeda, and yet there's enormous pressure to arm these forces to overthrow the al-Assad regime, and short shrift is given to the fate of Christian Syrians if these extremists come to power? I mean, in 1945, about 20% of Syria was Christian. Now, today it's descended to about 6%. But still, anybody who knows anything about Christianity knows that Syria has been historically very important to the history and reality of Christianity. And we're told that all of these God-fearing Christians like to protect their brethren, but basically they're throwing them to the walls. I mean, it's quite remarkable in helping to empower so-called fundamentalists. So that's the contradiction right now that many people are having difficulty sorting out. That is to say, you know, I mean, for example, like these chaps in London who said that they were killing this British soldier because Britain is waging a war against Islam. Well, I don't know. I mean, what about Syria? I mean, in Syria, Britain is supporting...
They're supporting the most backward element, what you're getting ready to say, the most backward elements in Syria, right?
Well, yeah, and also, you know, Islamic elements, just like they did the same thing in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And, you know, I guess what I'm saying, once again, is that the international community dominated by the North Atlantic powers, the part of the international community that's dominated by the North Atlantic powers, has taken a great leap backwards ideologically. I can't say that the world has taken a great leap backward, because I don't want to include some of our friends in Cuba. It reminds me, you know, we're going to talk about Mr. Obama's speech on where he basically tried to recalibrate the war on terrorism.
Right.
And he gave the usual litany about how the United States has faced slavery and fascism and communism and defeated them all. And then when he said communism, I had this vision in my mind of the Chinese communists, the Cuban communists, the Vietnamese communists, and elsewhere, say, hey, what about us? You know, we ain't defeated. It's really remarkable how you can have that sort of collective delusion. That's a very common statement south of the border, perhaps north of the border, too.
Oh, north of the border. I was at the meeting the other night, and a lot of people were trying to distance themselves from communism. They were pointing out that Yuri, the communists tried to recruit Yuri, but she never was a communist. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, it's here. Yeah.
I see. Well, you know, it's but there's no doubt, to put a finer point on it, that in the North Atlantic community and the parts of the world dominated by the North Atlantic community, that's been a great leap backwards ideologically. There's no doubt about it.
That's reflected
in the fact that you see both fighting and supporting Islamic extremists, so-called.
But I wanted you to finish that point on Islam by reiterating the point that you made on Saturday Morning Live many years ago when Brzezinski stood at the border, I think it was Afghanistan, and said that we Christians or we Americans should unite with the Muslims to fight the communists. Could you tell us about that story?
Oh, sure.
1979.
I mean, that was on the verge. Recall that in 1978, the left made a surge and basically came to power in Kabul, Afghanistan. And this was seen as a mortal threat
right. By
the North Atlantic powers, leading to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, going to the Pakistan-Afghan border, which is now one of the major hotspots in the world where U.S. drone warfare is concentrated, and basically making that pledge that you just enunciated, which led to the largest so-called covert intervention in CIA history, involving billions and billions of dollars pumped into Afghanistan to support the likes of Osama bin Laden. As I've told my friend Dedan Kamathi on KPFK, you know, I was alive in the 1980s when this was taking place. And I'm not that gregarious, but I think I know everybody personally who opposed that CIA intervention, which basically gives you an idea of how silent and complicit the U.S. left was
right
in the face of this major CIA covert intervention in league with reactionary religious fanatics. I mean, it's really quite astonishing in retrospect. And that plot is still playing itself out, as we just said. It's playing itself out in Syria. I mean, I think the conclusion you should arrive at is that U.S. imperialism, it reminds me of a bad movie where a character says, you know, stop me before I kill again. In other words, unless the left is powerful enough to restrain the imperialists, they will align with the most retrograde elements on the planet, even if these retrograde elements have in the back of their mind that they're going to attack U.S. imperialism, which is what they did on September 11, 2001. It's really something to see this being played out in real time. I mean, it would be one thing if I could just talk about this in the abstract, well, yes, U.S. imperialism will align with reactionary forces, even if those reactionary forces are determined to turn on U.S. imperialism. But basically, that's what you read in the newspapers every day. I mean, they're handing, it's not as if they're selling rope to individuals who want to hang them. It's almost as if they are helping to hang themselves. It's amazing.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author and activist. And I guess we wanted to move on to talk about President Barack Hussein Obama's new stand on terrorism. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, he gave this major speech, and, you know, Obama, he's big on giving major speeches. And I don't know. I mean, I think it left a lot of questions unanswered. That is to say, apparently drone warfare is going to continue. Presumably it'll just move from the CIA to the Pentagon. And I say presumably because it's really not clear from his remarks. Presumably the number of strikes will be reduced. And I say presumably because that's not clear either. Apparently the strikes on the Afghan-Pakistan border will be continuing. From a definitional point of view, the rationale for the strikes was reconfigured. That is to say, strikes not at those who are challenging U.S. interests, but strikes at those who are challenging U.S. persons. That's the new distinction. Time will tell if it's a distinction without a difference. But in any case, there's still a lot of dissatisfaction on the left with regard to the difficulty, shall we say, in closing the Guantanamo camp in Cuba, where people are sort of swept up from all over the world and then just dropped there with no due process of law in very difficult conditions. And that's one of the reasons why Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, this anti-war group, heckled Mr. Obama during the course of his remarks. But here is really the larger point, which is that the Republicans were totally dissatisfied with this speech. They said it was a surrender. If you look carefully, you would think that their opinion is that Mr. Obama finally unmasked himself as a Muslim militant in his own right, because supposedly he's now selling out the nation to Muslim extremism, so-called. Now, in light of what we've just been talking about for the past 10 minutes, I'm sure some in our audience must be scratching their heads trying to figure that one out. But I think what you should take away is that, and here's a point, too, that few people, even in the left, refuse to acknowledge, and that is that you have a very hard right political party in the United States that has a mass base, particularly amongst Euro-Americans, and they feel that they founded this nation, that they're the ones who increased slavery and liquidated First Nations, and therefore, like Marvin Gaye's father who says, you know, I brought you into this world, I can take you out, well, they say, well, we founded this nation, and it's our nation, we can do whatever we want with it, even if some of you think that we're jeopardizing the existence of everybody who lives here. That's the science fiction country in which we now reside.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. And we have about 6 minutes. If you want to go over, we can. If not, we can. We have a whole bunch of time. But I think we wanted to move on to talk about North Korea, China, and Japan, as well as China and the Caribbean.
Well, first of all, with regard to China and the Caribbean, and I was mentioning to another a friend the other day about how China is pouring billions into the Caribbean. I think I mentioned on Saturday Morning Live a few weeks ago, this big piece in China Daily about billions of Chinese investments in the Bahamas, just off the coast of South Florida, and how
right.
Lenny Kravitz, the well-known rocker who has a residence in Bahamas and is of Bahamian descent, was in one of the pictures as one of the partners with the Chinese. But the Chinese are also pouring major money throughout the region, major loans to Jamaica, for example, close relations with Guyana, for example. But I know that in our audience there are some who are, shall we say, highly skeptical of China right now. Well, this is what you need to be paying attention to now. As is well known, the U.S. and Canada and the European Union are rather petrified about the growth of the Chinese economy. The fact that China Daily had a piece a few days ago that suggested that the Chinese economy will be twice as large as the U.S. economy within a decade and a half, that is to say, within the lifetime of many of us. And as a result, what one of the results of this is the attempt to build up Japan as a counterweight to China. Now, I think this is going to end badly, but for those who don't like China, well, you know, if you want to bet on a horse, well, you know, maybe bet on Japan. Because even though the Japanese stock market fell sharply on Thursday, the fact of the matter is it's been growing at a spectacular rate of late. Japan had 3.5% economic growth in the last quarter. They had a major summit on Africa in the last week or so. And so for those who don't like Chinese investments in Africa, well, now I guess either you can salute or complain about Japanese investments in Africa, because they're about to make a big push. The Prime Minister of India is in Tokyo as we speak. And as you know, relations between India and Japan are quite close. I mean, going back 2,500 years to the founding of Buddhism. But this is going to be a major challenge, it seems to me, for China, since it doesn't have very good relations with Japan, doesn't have a good relations with India, doesn't have good relations with Vietnam, etc. And what's interesting is that we talked, I remember in April, about the North Korean crisis. Well, in the past week or so, the North Koreans invited a major political personality from Tokyo to visit, which is quite extraordinary, given the bad relations between Pyongyang and Tokyo. And I'm not sure what they were discussing, but I'm sure this visit was analyzed very closely in China. Because what happened subsequently was that a mandate came down from the Chinese authorities to Chinese media to curb the anti-Japan sentiment, which was quite extraordinary, since part of the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party is based upon their fight against Japan during World War II. And then, as we speak, a top leader from North Korea has just gone to China. So there are a lot of disparate moves taking place. I'm not sure what to make of it all, but I guess what I'm saying to your friends in Toronto, Norman, who you've told me about, who don't like China and don't like China's role in Africa, well, as I said, they can either start denouncing these other Asians or saluting these other Asians.
Let me say that Rupert Lewis sent me an email, and he wrote a letter to the editor, I think, of the Jamaican Observer, the great Mutaba Ruka, who is, I rate as, you know, one of our great spoken word artists, went on radio and made some very anti-Chinese statements, and Rupert called him out. I think it was published in the Jamaican Observer, or he sent a letter to the Jamaican Observer. I don't think know if they published it, but I will. I'll send it out to you later on today. And I wanted to say that in 2013 in Toronto, Canada, we're having African Liberation Day today, and it's almost like it's going back to the so-called Cold War period, where the African people's the All African People's Revolutionary Party is having one meeting. Guerrillas having one meeting at a different book list. Knowledge Bookstore in Brampton, they're having one. And last night they had, and today they're having something with a friend of mine by the name of Ojamo. It looks like we are, instead of uniting, this is the 50th anniversary of the OAU, but I guess you hadn't finished talking about China yet. If you have any thoughts on that, if you want to cut us loose, it's your time, so it's on you.
Yeah, I'm probably going to have to sign off, but I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Definitely. We'll be on next week, so thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. We have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, and we're going to continue with